This time on your weekly constitutional, James Madison University President John Alger on a recent meeting at Montpelier.
1619 was an important moment in the history of our country. That was the beginning of representative government with the House of Burgesses, but also, unfortunately, the introduction of slavery in what became the United States, also the introduction of women in larger numbers, and of course, the first Thanksgiving. So this was an opportunity to talk about where we've been, where we are currently, and then where we're going from here in our democratic society.
I'm Stuart Harris. It's your weekly constitutional, and this week it's about Virginia in the Vanguard.
Don't change that station. It's time for your weekly constitutional, a weekly discussion of interesting constitutional issues, from gay rights to gun rights. YWC is produced in partnership with the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier, and is hosted by Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at Lincoln Memorial University's Duncan School of Law in Knoxville, Tennessee.
Recently, I was honored to be included in a very important meeting at James Madison's Montpelier. It was called Virginia in the Vanguard, and it examined the many contributions, past, present, and future, of the great Commonwealth of Virginia to American representative democracy. While I was there, I collared several people and dragged them into the studio with me, but I didn't get a chance to drag one of them there. His name is John Alger. He's the president of James Madison University. And so I made a trip out to Harrisonburg, and we sat down in the studios of WMRA and talked about our recent experience. So, Jonathan Alger, welcome back to the show.
It's great to be with you, Stuart.
Absolutely, and thanks so very much. I want to say right at the very beginning to WMRA and the station manager, Matt Bengay, who has been so kind. In fact, this is the second or third or maybe fourth time that we've sat in these wonderful studios here at JMU. In fact, you and I have talked about several things. We've talked about, what was it, affirmative action? We've talked about the We the People program. Mm-hmm. We have talked about civic engagement at JMU. I mean, we've talked about a whole host of things, and so I'll plug our website. Just Google Your Weekly Constitutional. You come up with our podcast site. We're also on iTunes and Spotify. If you go to the podcast site, you can enter the search bar and just enter the word Alger, A-L-G-E-R. Did I get that right?
Yes.
And that'll bring up pretty much every interview that John and I have had in the past, but he's an old pro, and we've talked about interesting things, and you might want to check him out. So tell me, what are we talking about today, John?
Well, first of all, Stuart, again, it's great to be with you, and it's a timely and important topic that we're here to talk about today. You and I had the privilege a few weeks ago of participating in a seminar meeting called Virginia in the Vanguard. And what this was an opportunity for colleges, universities, but also thought leaders across Virginia to come together and reflect on 400 years of history here in Virginia. We all know that 1619 was an important moment in the history of our country. That was the beginning of representative government with the House of Burgesses, but also, unfortunately, the introduction of slavery in what became the United States in the Virginia colony.
Wow, quite a contrast there.
Absolutely. Also, the introduction of women in larger numbers as they wanted to make the colony more permanent, and of course, the first Thanksgiving. And so, as we can see, Virginia was really in the vanguard in early American history and has continued to be so in many respects. So this was an opportunity to talk about where we've been, where we are currently, and then where we're going from here in our democratic society at a time when there are a lot of divisions in society, a lot of concerns about the state and the health of democracy. So we thought this was a great opportunity to bring great minds together to reflect on those questions.
So it's not just another Virginia brag fest, we're better than the other 49 states?
Absolutely not. No, we recognize that this is a checkered history. There are some great accomplishments, of course, here in Virginia, some tremendous leaders, including several of our presidents in the founding period, including James Madison. But there are also some very troubled parts of our history. And part of the concept when we reflect on our Constitution, our system of government, and this question of what do we mean by we the people, is that that's always been a work in progress, even today. So this meeting was an opportunity to talk about how do we become more inclusive in realizing the vision that's reflected in those words.
Absolutely. All joking aside, this is a very serious endeavor, and a shout out to our mutual friends over at Montpelier for hosting a wonderful conference on this. I think it spanned two and a half days.
Yes.
And we had some very important people there, as you say, thought leaders, people who are participating in this commemoration of 1619 and others. We had fascinating people. We had the fellow who plays James Madison at Colonial Williamsburg, Brian Austin. We also had my very good friend from the University of Virginia, A.E. Dick Howard. He is a wonderful professor of constitutional law. He gave us a presentation one evening. He's been on the show several times, too. We've actually talked about everything with Dick, from Magna Carta to most recently something he calls constitutional migration. In fact, I think that episode is up on the site. We did that recording at Montpelier about how American constitutional ideas came to us from other nations and then have been sent back out into the world and have influenced other constitutions. Also did a great interview with Brian, where he did half the interview or two-thirds of it in character, and then the last third, he explained what it means to be a Madison interpreter. Right. He is quite a scholar in his own right.
Yes.
So that was just a great, great weekend, a great, great event, extremely important stuff. But let's take those things you mentioned one at a time and talk about them, shall we? 1619, first beginnings of representative government, the oldest continuously meeting English-speaking legislative body, actually in the world, not just in the United States. And that is because Parliament was suspended for a certain period of time since 1619, whereas the House of Burgesses never has.
Of course, this is an ideal upon which our nation was founded, this idea of representative government, not just absolute monarchy, and we're very proud of that in the United States. And yet, as we know, it's, as I said, been a work in progress. When it started, of course, it was white male landowners, so a very small subset of the overall population, even at the time. And certainly, as we look at how diverse our state and our nation have become since then, this idea of we the people has got to be expanded, and that's part of this constitutional ideal. If you did have James Madison here today, if he were to look at the nation's population, one wonders what he would think about where we are and where we need to go from here. But it is an important part of our history, a very important part of Virginia's contributions to our nation and to our world. But we also have the obligation and the responsibility to think about where do we go from here? How do we build on that history? How do we make sure that we're living up to the lofty ideals that we've talked about for 400 years?
I absolutely agree with you on that. In fact, something I like to do when I go out and make a public presentation, I will look at the audience, I'll see all sorts of different people, and I will ask everybody to stand. Then I will say, okay, if you are a person of color, please sit. If you are a person of the female persuasion, please sit. And that always takes out a little more than half the audience. If you are under 21, please sit. If you are a person who doesn't own any significant property, please sit. And what are you left with? A bunch of old gray-headed guys like me. And I look around and say, okay, guys, we were large and in charge. We were it. Nobody else in this room had a seat at the table. And that's a really striking experience for a lot of people. And it really brings home to them, both for those who were seated and for those who are still standing.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think that's a big part of when we talk about the 400th anniversary of several events. Of course, the introduction of slavery being one, the introduction of women to the colony being another. You know, these are parts of our history that we have to come to grips with. And we know that slavery, of course, was in many ways seen as the original sin of our Constitution and our system of government. It was basically enshrined into the Constitution. We, of course, had that three-fifths clause that is of quite concern to many people when they look at our history.
Sure.
So those are things that are realities that still impact us in our society today. And part of the conversation that we had at Montpelier and part of the national conversation that we're having now is how do we come to grips with that history? Not to deny it, not to gloss over it, but to recognize how far we've come. Certainly legally and in many other respects, we've come a long way. We do have more people at the table, but we still have a long way to go to really try to provide equal opportunity for people of all backgrounds in our country.
Absolutely. And of course, discussions of slavery are always a bit depressing and upsetting, even as they continue to fascinate. I mean, the more I learn about this, the more I see the recent scholarship on the subject, the more intricate I see it, the more complexity there is. But on the other hand, you can also look at the great sweep of history, constitutional history, and you can take some comfort from it. because it is, as who said this? Was it Martin Luther King or was it Gandhi who said the arc of history bends upward? Well, just take the typical starting point that I mentioned a moment ago, Magna Carta in 1215. People frequently will trace British and American constitutional history from that point forward because that was the first time that a group of barons, a group of the elites, wrested some power from, I think it was King John. He was an absolute monarch up to that point, which was, of course, the model in Europe. They were just, I mean, that was a tiny group of people who were already extremely powerful. In fact, in many respects, they were, you know, they were just as much lords within their little feudal realms as the king was over the entire kingdom. And it was basically them making sure that their rights were protected. It didn't really change much for people on the ground. I mean, literally on the ground. There's an old Monty Python skit where two of them are on the ground and they're, I can't repeat it because there's some profanity in it, but basically they're contrasting their existence with those of the feudal lords. And I can paraphrase here. One of them said, well, how do you know he's a lord? Because he's not covered with excrement. and they were.
Yes.
From that beginning, and that's over 800 years ago now, we're at the point now, at least in the United States, where we have virtually universal adult suffrage. As you said, long ways to go, not always even, not always enforced, not everybody has equal access to the ballot box, continuing discussions on that. But at least in our Constitution, if you are 18 or above, you can presumptively vote.
Right.
And so that is a lot of progress.
It is. And I think we always have to keep that in mind. And I too love that quote about the arc of history, because
yes,
it's a reminder at those moments of frustration that we all have when we think that, my goodness, shouldn't we be at a better place now after 400 years, to reflect back on the fact that we have done a great deal as a society. And certainly the American experiment, I think, has been an important part of world history. And as you said, has spread to many other countries. Our Constitution has served as a model in many other nations. In fact, our university, James Madison University, has worked with the Republic of Kosovo. We're also doing more work with Rwanda in Africa, two countries that have suffered from genocide, two countries that were trying to bring diverse people together without killing each other, to look forward about how you can live together, work together, and make sure that everybody has a seat at the table in peace. And in both cases, they look at the United States as a model. They look at our Constitution and our history as a model, and yet they're also making tremendous improvements in their own societies based on their own histories. We have a lot to learn from some of those experiments, even as we have a lot to learn from our own history.
Absolutely. You never stop learning. And so as much as you and I are both devotees of our Constitution, I think I can speak for both of us when I say we don't worship it. We've discussed
right.
this before, and we discussed James Madison. I mean, he's a great guy, and he did wonderful things, and you've got a bust of him in your office. But we noted that there's a chip in that bust
right.
of Madison, and that's a great thing because it reminds us that he was a flawed human being.
And I think for all of us, when we think about democracy, it's about people. And we know that people are not perfect. And James Madison himself wrote a lot about this. He talked about the fact that if men were angels, we wouldn't need government. But then, of course, he goes on to say, but we know that's not the case. And so, therefore, we need to come up with a system of government that will take into account different factions, different types of people, and how do you bring them together in community to live together and work together in peace. One of the things we've done at our own university to reflect that chip, if you will, is to name a new residence hall for Paul Jennings. That residence hall opened this fall on our campus with 500 beds. Paul Jennings was enslaved at Montpelier. He essentially became James Madison's right-hand man and worked with him until Madison's death. Paul Jennings later became a free man and an abolitionist. And as someone who actually wrote the first memoir from the White House.
Not so the first slave memoir, the first memoir
right.
at all. Yeah.
Exactly. So an important historical figure in his own right. But we wanted to celebrate the more complete history of the founding, not to deny the great contributions of James Madison, but to acknowledge that there were many other people involved in the founding of our country and to recognize those accomplishments and contributions. So the naming of Paul Jennings Hall is one way of doing that. And something I'm very excited about, as we dedicate that building in October, we will have descendants of Paul Jennings, members of his family who will be with us, as well as representatives from Montpelier, to talk about the significance of this moment. So it's that opportunity to tell the more complete story of our history, to recognize the accomplishments, the contributions of people of all backgrounds, that I think is an important step for us to take as a society.
I'm so glad you're including the Jennings descendants. That's such an important thing to include in the commemoration, even the planning of the commemoration, the opinions of the people who were most directly affected. In fact, I committed a bit of a gaffe in an earlier interview. I was speaking with the woman at Montpelier who does the outreach to the enslaved community. And I made the comment, I'm so glad that this history is coming to light because nobody knows about it. And she kind of looked at me and she said, well, the African-American community never forgot this.
Absolutely.
It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. And this week, my guest is JMU President Jonathan Alger, with whom I'm discussing a recent meeting at Montpelier called Virginia in the Vanguard. Stick around. Listening to your Weekly Constitutional, I'm Stuart Harris, and now we're going to continue our discussion with James Madison University President John Alger about a program recently hosted at James Madison's Montpelier. It was called Virginia in the Vanguard, and it's all about democracy and how Virginia has played such a leading role in the past, in the present, and we hope in the future. Just before the break, we were talking about something that Montpelier calls hard history. Typically, at least at Montpelier, it involves slavery, things that people just don't like to talk about. I also spoke to other people at Montpelier about the pushback that they are getting on commemorating slavery. They have an award-winning exhibit, you know, there, the Mere Distinction of Color, which comes from another Madison quote, and it's all about slavery. And they relatively recently installed a bulletin board, and people can leave comments. Many of the comments are negative. You know, I didn't come here to hear about slaves. I want to hear about James Madison.
Right.
It's as if they just want to erase the uncomfortable parts. And I think a lot of us, especially people of European extraction in this country, are kind of complicit in that. At least we have been.
We certainly have. And I think it's not to deny the great contributions of James Madison and the other founding fathers, but they were not perfect. And I think there's a difference between respect and reverence. You mentioned that earlier, that with the founding fathers, if we put them up on a pedestal, we think of big marble statues that make them larger than life, we forget that these were real human beings who were creatures of their time, just as we are today.
Slavery is our original constitutional sin, but the 1619 commemoration points out that it predates our actual Constitution and by a significant amount of time. It was the original American sin, but that was the moment when that contradiction really came into focus for the first time. On the one hand, hey, we got representative government, yay us. And oh, by the way, it doesn't count these black people. And they arrived on a ship, a little unexpected, let's enslave them. You know, let's put them in shackles. Let's treat them as property. And it all started at that moment simultaneously. But what are some of the happier things that happened in 1619? We've talked about slavery and representative government's happy.
Yes.
What are the other things?
And certainly, you know, the introduction of women, although women certainly were not treated equally to men at the time. Again, that's certainly a story where we've come a long way. We still have a ways to go. Women, of course, now have the right to vote. We're celebrating the 100th anniversary of an amendment to our Constitution in the next year. It was a very important moment in American history to recognize literally half of our population. So that's a story that has changed and evolved over time, and we continue to struggle with making sure that women have equal opportunities in leadership at all levels of government and in society in general. But we've certainly come a long way, and we had some important voices at Montpelier, and we have important voices at our university that remind us of the tremendous contributions of women in our society. So I think this year is a great opportunity to remember and recognize those contributions. And then, of course, there's the first Thanksgiving.
Before we get
to
Thanksgiving, that's the happiest subject of all of these, people are probably a little bit confused. What do you mean women showed up? Well, think of the timeline. 1607 is when Jamestown is established. Right. And boy, they had a hard time of it, too. Almost starved, almost failed. It's really kind of funny when you go back and read the Jamestown charters. You know, they were literally called gentlemen adventurers.
Yes.
And, you know, they had a council, and that was, you know, in some sense, the beginning of self-government. It was formalized in 1619 with the House of Burgesses. But there weren't women among them. Women were not actively recruited to come. until that moment in 1619, right, when someone looked around and said, you know, if we really want to grow this colony, we can't make babies here without the other half of the population, and maybe life would be better anyway to include the ladies. And so some bright fellow said, let's recruit some. And that's when women really started arriving in larger numbers.
Right. And if you look to get back to the history of Virginia for a moment, women have played an important role long before they were able to vote. Someone like Dolly Madison, for example, was a very important historical figure in her own right. She, in many ways, made James Madison more complete. She was the social hostess that brought people together, whether it was at Montpelier or in the White House, and continued to do so after his death. She was very well known and respected. In fact, the first person to be known as the First Lady of our country. And she's just one example of the fact that women, often behind the scenes for much of our history, were making important contributions. They understood how to bring people together. They understood some of the challenges our country faced. Abigail Adams said famously to her husband, "Don't forget about the ladies."
Yes.
And I think that's been part of our history that we're still talking about today. But this is something I think when we look back at 400 years, how far we've come in the span of human history, a lot really has happened since then. And I think it's important to have that context, that memory, but then also to say, and where do we go from here? What's the hard work ahead of us?
Absolutely. In fact, I think it's really kind of funny that guys who were already here had to kind of look around and say, hey, maybe we should have some girls, you know, maybe we should bring a few on. And from that moment where some men decided to recruit some women, now we're almost exactly 100 years, as you pointed out, for women gaining complete citizenship and, you know, full suffrage.
I just was just in a meeting the other day with a colleague from Rwanda. I mentioned that our university has been working with Rwanda, which has really been working hard at reconciliation, not just at peace, but at genuine reconciliation of the different factions that literally were killing each other not too long ago with the genocide in that country. And one of the things that was fascinating about this conversation is the role of women in that country. And our visitor mentioned that about two-thirds of government officials in that country are women. And who would think that they would be so far ahead of us in Africa, in a relatively new country on that front? But it's something that they have recognized in their society, the important role of women in educating women. My own university was founded, by the way, as an all-women's teachers' college. And of course, that was the role a little over 100 years ago that women were often assigned to in terms of the workplace. Now, of course, we're producing women in all disciplines across the curriculum. But it's a great reminder that this is all very personal in some ways. When we think about history, sometimes I think we look at it in the abstract. We think of people as these big, larger-than-life marble figures. But when you bring it down to the personal level, you think about your wives, your daughters, your mothers, and your friends and colleagues that you work with, I think it helps us to put a lot of this into perspective. It's also a reminder that as individuals, there's a great impact that all of us can make on our society. That's what we talk about with our students as well, that each one of you individually has a much greater voice and a much greater ability to impact change than you might realize.
I'm so glad you emphasized that, and you're president of a university, and so you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that there is now a majority, a female majority in American higher education. I think maybe we're at that point with law schools as well. Certainly, I see a lot of women in my classrooms these days, and of course, I welcome this. I'm no sociologist, but from what I've read, when people study things about gender representation in society, more power to women benefits everybody. Because when you give women power and control, they spend it on good things like healthcare, and they spend it on things like education and early childhood interventions and all these very good things, and society simply is a better place. So I like to say that although obviously the greatest beneficiaries of the 19th Amendment, the greatest emancipation of a majority of our citizens, the greatest beneficiaries were women, I think we all win because of it. I think life has gotten measurably better since 1920, when that amendment went into effect.
Absolutely. And it's true in so many ways. When we think about higher education and the benefits we've had from becoming more diverse and making sure that we have men and women in all of our academic disciplines and making sure that we have people of all racial and ethnic backgrounds in our colleges and universities, that diversity has had educational benefits for all students. We all learn a lot more, and we all have a lot to contribute when we're in a more diverse and accessible environment. So, for example, in the sciences, a lot of research has improved in the area of healthcare as more women came into leadership positions because they said, wait a minute, you can't just test a particular drug or treatment on one gender. There may be differences.
There's a thought.
Exactly.
Do women get sick too? Yeah, maybe they do.
And maybe certain types of treatments or medications might impact them differently. So we've come a long way, I think, certainly in higher education by recognizing that we need those voices at the table and at every level, including at leadership levels. And so it's something at James Madison University, I'm very proud of our history. You mentioned gender now in American higher education. About almost 60% of our students are women, and that's true, again, in many different disciplines, and that's true in American higher education in general. So our future, in many respects, is going to ride on having that inclusive leadership, having women have an important seat at the table. We need it as a society, and it's something that as a university we think about every day.
I can tell a personal story of how I have benefited from that. My alma mater was single sex for all throughout its history, but then it went co-ed, as we used to say, in 1969. And there was great hue and cry from the alumni and threats to stop contributions and all the rest of it. By the time I arrived on campus 10 years later, that we were celebrating a decade of co-education. And I benefited specifically because I was able to date my fellow students and had a long-term girlfriend in college. And this was of great benefit to me. And I remember those days fondly. And I was helping out at reunions when a fellow from the class of 1912 needed to be driven around in a golf cart, right? Mm-hmm. And he was a very nice old guy. And he said, "Well, what do you think about these women? Are they distracting the men?" And I said, "Yes, but in a very good way."
Yes.
In a very good way. And we're distracting them as well. But that was their feeling, is that, you know, the core of the university was still the men and the women were add-ons. And the test was, are they distracting the men?
Right.
So, yeah. And I don't think those sort of conversations happen too frequently there anymore.
I hope not. I think we've outgrown that,
right? What's that old expression? The progress of science depends on the death of scientists.
Yes.
And I think that's probably true societally as well. Okay, so we've talked about three of the four things that we're commemorating the 400th anniversary of. We've talked about women. We have talked about the House of Burgesses and representative democracy. And we've also talked about slavery. Finally, and this is the part where I think maybe Virginia's just being Virginia, they're trying to convince us that Thanksgiving was not a Massachusetts thing, it was a Virginia thing. Do you believe them?
Well, you know, of course, I was not there at the time, but I suspect because this idea of Thanksgiving and being grateful for the harvest has been around for a lot longer than American history. It really is a worldwide phenomenon in many respects. So I suspect that there probably were some celebrations at harvest time, even back in 1619, before the famous Pilgrims Thanksgiving in Massachusetts. What I think is interesting about this is it gives us, again, this context of thinking about how people came together, and specifically the colonists and Native Americans, who, of course, were the ones that were here long before the white folks arrived from Europe. And one of the fascinating things at our Virginia the Vanguard meeting is that we had Native American voices at the table, and it was so important and relevant for us to be reminded when we talk about this great history and what's happened in Virginia to know that, you know, there was a lot of history before 1619.
Yes.
In Virginia. And even today, of course, we have Native American tribes who are in Virginia. Those are voices that perhaps had been forgotten that are now rising up and saying, don't forget about us. We're an important part of the history. And going forward, we need to be part of the conversation and to be included at the table. So that idea of we the people, that's yet another element of who we are that we need to recognize and acknowledge.
We were rather pointedly reminded of the fact that before the Madisons, that particular plot of land that is still so beautiful today was the property of local Indians.
Absolutely.
And I think people at the table, at least I felt a little twinge of embarrassment because we had glossed over that fact until we were the wider group was reminded of it by a Native American representative at that conference. And his contributions especially were very welcome. And he was very informed about these issues and gave me, I know personally, a lot better perspective.
Right, right. And, you know, when I think about these whole issues of we the people and of government, we so often talk as though we own the place, if you will. And of course, this is a country of immigrants. Most of us, that is our background. The Native Americans were here long before any of the rest of us. But it's a reminder that humanity, the common humanity that we all share, to me, is so much more important in some respects than any one group laying claim to history, to a form of government, or to saying, especially here in the United States, that look, we're the ones that created this place or this space. So part of that work of Virginia in the Vanguard is to recognize that common humanity, to recognize the contributions of every group, and to say that as we go forward, all of us have roles to play, and we need to acknowledge each other, we need to respect one another, and we need to find ways to work together. That's, at the end of the day, what democracy is all about. And in higher education, one of the most important responsibilities I think we have with our students is to make sure that they are aware of their surroundings, of people from other backgrounds, whether it's race or religion or socioeconomic background or gender. You know, we all can learn so much from one another, but we all need to learn how to live and work together. And we're now at a time, of course, when boundaries disappear with the internet, right? We can communicate instantly with people all across the world. That's a wonderful opportunity, but it also creates a lot of challenges. And in higher education, part of our role is to help students to think about what does it mean to be a citizen of the United States, as well as a global citizen? What are your rights, but what are your responsibilities? And that's a conversation I think our students are ready and willing to have.
You're listening to Your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. Today, my guest is James Madison University President John Alger, and he's been talking about efforts that JMU is making to make its students better citizens. It's Your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Jonathan Alger, the president of James Madison University, whom I had the pleasure of seeing recently at Montpelier for a program called Virginia in the Vanguard, all about how Virginia has played a leading role in promoting democracy and self-government in the past, in the present, and now we're segueing to the future, because now we're talking about efforts that JMU is making to build better citizens. One way to be a better citizen is to treat everyone with respect, including people who have recently arrived here. And of course, the issue of immigration is very much on people's minds today, and it's very, very constitutional. And so it's always good to remind ourselves that we all are immigrants. In fact, if you go back far enough, and the historians and the archaeologists are still arguing over this, but even the indigenous people here came across from Asia. Right. Somehow, whether it was boats or a land bridge or whatever it was. And so we all have an origin from someplace else. But back to the pilgrims, I think the people of Massachusetts pulled off a great PR stunt. Did you dress up as a pilgrim when you were a kid?
Oh, absolutely. Everything. That was something we did every year.
The paper hats, yes. And the belt buckles and all this sort of stuff. Yes. And the girls would wear the little bonnets. I think most people, maybe even today, people of a certain age, think of that as really the beginning of at least European civilization in the United States. But of course, we know that people were down in Virginia decades earlier, right?
Right. Yeah.
Part of it's probably because they had the better backstory. They were coming for religious freedom.
Right.
The gentlemen adventurers were looking for gold, right?
Right.
Okay, so they didn't make quite as sympathetic a group of people. But we know, and I think I agree with you, Thanksgiving in one form or another has been long predated European colonization of this part of the world. So I think it's probably quite true that Virginia had the first one here that at least was participated in by Europeans. Very interesting stuff. Also reminds me that while the pilgrims came for their own religious freedom, they had a great way of oppressing people disagreed with them. And I'm thinking of a relatively obscure figure in our history named Roger Williams, who had been a dissenter back in England, had been imprisoned there. They let him out of prison. He comes to Massachusetts Bay. Here I am, guys. Isn't this great? We're all dissenters. Then they decided they didn't like him in Massachusetts Bay, so they exiled him. But what did he do? He went out to what most people assumed was a death sentence, and instead of encountering savages, he encountered people. And instead of trying to force them to conform to his religious beliefs, he simply explained his religious beliefs, and he invited them to join him if they wished. He also respected their religious beliefs. He didn't coerce anybody. He just basically said, hey, guys, I'm here. Let's all get along. And he's the guy who basically founded Rhode Island and established it on the basis of religious freedom. So there is a right way to do this stuff.
Yes. And we have, you know, heroes and heroines, many of names that we don't necessarily know. And I think it's important to tell those stories. And I feel as an educator, that's part of our responsibility. Again, not to erase history and not to ignore the contributions of the names that we know in the history books, like the Founding Fathers, but to tell that more complete story. Because part of what that does is I think it gives us today a sense of agency, that not everybody has to be a president of the United States or a founding father to make significant contributions to our society. And I think that's an important responsibility that we have in higher education, is to raise up those stories and to get students to reflect on how they might be the next Roger Williams in their own way. And what are the challenges of today that we ought to be thinking about? What are those blind spots that we ought to be paying attention to? And for them to feel that sense that, yes, I too can make a difference and be part of that historical arc.
Absolutely. In fact, another story comes to mind. Although we typically trace our constitutional history back to Britain, and that's legitimate, most of it does come from there. Of course, there were other influences on the British from other places, mostly Europe. But we sometimes overlook the fact that there is definitely American Indian influence on our Constitution. Not only do they have a special constitutional status, not only are there references to them as indigenous nations, but my favorite founder, Ben Franklin, was once called to a conference up in Albany, New York, and was called the Albany Conference. And those historians will quibble over this. The story that I've always heard is that the conference was there to basically talk about what the colonies could do to deal with the various threats they faced from France, from Spain, from indigenous people. And Franklin basically came up with the idea that we need to join together. In fact, he actually created that famous logo, that famous editorial cartoon with the rattlesnake cut into segments, and it said, "Join or die." Well, that was more than just figure of speech. He actually had a plan that was remarkably similar to the Constitution that would be adopted 30 years later, that included many of the same elements. And the story goes that he was inspired to create this plan because he admired the Iroquois Nation. They were a united series of tribes, and they were at the table as well, and they had a lot more clout because they had their confederation. They had their system of government. You said earlier that places like Rwanda, where there had been so much death in the past, really are benefiting from this government. That's the stark contrast. That's the importance of government. If you don't have government, you have chaos. And when you have chaos, it's the biggest, baddest guys who are going to try to rule everything and are all going to fight with each other. And the next thing you know, you have genocide. That's why this stuff is so important.
Yeah, and I worry today that there's this growing sense of apathy and frustration, not just in the United States, but indeed around the world. We see it in a lot of democratic societies, that we face a lot of difficult challenges, whether it's climate change, you know, hunger and poverty, extreme disparities in terms of economics. And I think a lot of people just throw up their hands and feel like, well, you know, let's look for a strong man or woman, someone that can take control and give us simple solutions. And the solutions are hard. They're difficult. But these are concerns that we're seeing around the world. I was at a conference recently in Strasbourg in France, at the Council of Europe headquarters, and there were representatives from all over the world talking about the fact that our young people need that encouragement to know that, look, for democracy to work, every generation has to play its part. Our founding fathers knew that. They did not just create a piece of parchment and say, okay, now the work is done. The implication was that every generation had to seize the moment to take leadership, to take responsibility, to make this work. And that's hard work. And today's students, I think, have a hunger to do that. But all around them, they see signs of apathy and frustration. And I think, again, part of our responsibility as educators today is to say, look, yes, we've left you with a lot of big problems, but you also have great opportunities. And this idea of a system of government is to provide a framework where you can work together, where you can compromise, which has become a dirty word in American politics. But to bring people together in a framework to try to solve difficult problems and challenges. I think our students want to do that. And there are improvements that we're going to need to make, certainly in our system of government at every level, not just in the United States, but across the world, for democracy to continue to thrive. I think as Americans, we've taken it for granted in some sense, because we talk about the fact and we celebrate the fact that the Constitution has been around for so long. And yet we know that it's our responsibility to continue that tradition. It won't just happen because there's a piece of paper with words on it.
Exactly. The arc of history may indeed bend upward, but not automatically. You have to make the effort. Every generation has to make the effort, and no generation chooses when it's born. Some generations have greater responsibilities and greater opportunities than others. I believe Franklin Roosevelt said that this generation has a rendezvous with history. It did, and that's why we call them the greatest generation. And if you think about it, the challenges they faced were far greater than the ones we face now. There was, of course, the 1930s and fascism arising all over the world. Now, there are some troubling parallels today.
Yes, there are.
But we haven't gone quite that far down the road, and there is still plenty of opportunity to fight back. There's plenty of opportunity to make our democracy more representative, to make sure that everybody's vote counts the same as everybody else's vote, to make sure that we don't have such great disparities of wealth and opportunity that people feel completely disaffected and maybe even prone to not care anymore or ultimately maybe engage in violence. Right. That is the task of government, and those are the challenges that face every generation to varying extents. But you got to keep your optimism, and you got to remember that we've been through tough times before.
Yes, and you know our students. One of the challenges as we've become more diverse in higher education, it's interesting. Students don't necessarily automatically embrace the notion of free speech the way that the founders
it's so troubling
talked about. And I understand in some sense where they're coming from. They worry about offending other people. And yet, this is an important part of our tradition to be able to have that freedom of conscience to bring different ideas to the table. But there's also a skill set involved in how you do that constructively. And I believe, again, as educators, that's so important for us to help students not to deny their differences, to learn how to bring them out, to share them, certainly to argue, but to do it in a way that recognizes our common humanity, that respects each other. And that's something that we're really striving for at a place like James Madison University. We know that students are not all going to agree with one another. That's not the goal of a university.
It's not.
Quite the opposite. But helping students become comfortable with that, to learn those skills of democracy, and to practice those in a safe space, that's really what higher education is all about. So, for example, I co-teach a leadership seminar, and we bring in experts in debate to teach the students how to debate. And by the way, the students don't get to choose which side of an issue they're on. We actually assign them, which can be very uncomfortable for students. But the point is for them to learn how to make good arguments, how to use facts and evidence. This is something we're trying to do across the curriculum.
Facts and,
I know, facts, they still matter.
Okay.
We believe that in higher education, and we're facing a situation right now with the polarization in our society, even going to things like whether evidence matters, whether expertise matters. And I tell our students all the time, look, would you want to go to a surgeon that had never been to medical school? Would you want to fly in a plane with a pilot who'd never been trained? Probably not. So expertise does matter in these different fields. We need to respect that and constantly improve upon it. And that's what higher education is all about.
It is. And I know that there's at least one place down the road a ways where they take those issues extremely seriously. I had the great pleasure of participating in a First Amendment awareness event at Appalachian State University. Mm-hmm. It's called Say What. We did a whole episode on it. So again, if you're interested, you can go to the podcast site and simply search for Say What. And they actually had me give a presentation, which involved a great deal of interaction with the audience. And one young lady was very, very straightforward. She said, well, I know free speech is one of the things that makes America great, but I just don't like it. I don't like it when people disagree with things that I think are true. And of course, the audience sort of burst out laughing. And I said, well, thank you very much for being honest about that and recognizing the contradiction. That's the price of free speech. You can't just protect your own free speech. You got to protect the other guys. Right. And that's the price of tolerating free speech, is you got to tolerate some really nasty speech as well. And although, as you alluded to, the internet cuts both ways, and we're very concerned about the rise of so-called hate speech and extreme opinions, and those are real issues that we need to address. We've got to be very careful before we just start cutting people off, or at least before we let the government start doing that. And you're part of the government. You're a state university. Have you encountered some recent significant free speech issues on your campus?
Certainly we have at James Madison University, and I think every campus in the United States, at least the healthy ones, will inevitably run into controversies. We've had faculty who've expressed their strong opinions, perhaps in some cases in the media or to outside constituencies, and people get very upset thinking, how could the university tolerate having people with these particular views? We've certainly had, you know, students who've protested about different issues who want to raise their voices on the big issues of the day. That's something that, again, we actually need to encourage. Now, there are constructive ways of doing that and destructive ways of doing that. And I do believe that there need to be rules of engagement. Mm-hmm. So part of what we try to help students understand is that if you're trying to make change, that you need to understand how to work with other people, how to be persuasive. And that's where the hard work comes in. And, you know, it's not that you can get tenure, say, in a field like astronomy if you teach that the moon is made of green cheese, right? Unless you've got
I
hate to burst your bubble, Stuart.
Yeah, I tell you what, those facts again, getting
that's,
in the way.
That's right. But you know, that, part of what we talk about in higher education is what are the kinds of evidence that back up the work that you do in different areas. And we do have those standards and disciplines, whether it's history or biology or music. So expertise does matter. And of course, that's why we have education in this country. And by the way, you know, the founding fathers recognized the importance of higher education so much that a number of them initially talked about having some sort of national university, because they knew to have leadership in democracy, you needed people that were educated and that understood these rules of engagement. It's a shame in some ways, perhaps, that that didn't come to pass, although we have many public universities, as you've pointed out now, all across the country. But I think that's part of our responsibility, is to help students get comfortable with those rules of engagement. Yes, with their freedoms, but, you know, we talk an awful lot about rights in our country, and we talk less so about the responsibilities that go along with those rights. That's the balancing act, I think, that we have to talk about in a democracy. Because, yes, you have free speech, but you also need to listen. And you also have a responsibility to learn from people who are different from you. That's the skill set that we're trying to teach.
Absolutely. And as I always tell my students, I'm going to challenge you. And we're going to talk about things that you're going to have very strong opinions on. And you're going to find out that your classmates have the opposite perspective. And that's okay, because that's part of the learning process. And all I ever require of them is that they treat each other with mutual respect. That's it. And beyond that, you know, that's part of the educational process. In fact, some of the best classes I've ever taught are where I talk the least, where the students get into a discussion and I can just kind of sit there and watch it, maybe nudge it a little bit occasionally. Those are the ones I really look forward to. Yeah. Talk about this leadership seminar that you teach.
Yes.
How do you teach leadership? I mean, other than civil discourse, other than what we've talked about,
right?
What else is necessary to be a good leader today?
Well, you know, one of the things we talk about is that students of all backgrounds and different personalities can be leaders. And all of us in different contexts will have opportunities for leadership. Sometimes that might mean you have a formal title, like being president of an organization. But in many cases, there is leadership in terms of dealing with issues or dealing with different projects or initiatives. And we want all students to know that they have that capacity to embrace and understand their own personalities and how to use those strengths, and then how to complement their strengths and weaknesses with people around them. So our students work in teams throughout the entire semester. That, by the way, can be uncomfortable because a lot of your grade is dependent on relying upon your team colleagues. Well, that's real life. As we both know, in many workplace contexts, you will be working in teams
don't get to choose which team you're on.
You don't
frequently
get to choose, and how you are judged is not just going to be based on how you do, but is going to be based on how the team has functioned. So that, I think, has been an important part of the learning process for the students. We also spend a lot of time on communication skills, not just talking. Of course, they do presentations, they do debates, but they also focus on things like active listening. One of the most undervalued leadership skills, I think, is listening. And when we talk about we the people trying to be more inclusive as a country, I think where we've been at our best is when leaders actually have listened to those voices. So that's something we talk about a lot with our students. How do you listen actively in groups? And then how do you benefit from that listening in terms of how you modify your own behavior and your decisions? So it's a lot of fun. It's a very hands-on course. The students also do things like community service learning so that they get their hands dirty, so to speak, working in the community, identifying some of the challenges of our time, and then working with community partners alongside them to try to address those types of challenges.
I seem to recall one young man a couple of years ago when I was here for the Madison Vision Series. He had actually gone out and located an area where he felt there should be another electoral polling station.
Indeed.
And he got it done. I mean, he put a polling station where it needed to be so that people who needed to vote could get to the polls.
Right. That was a significant example of the idea of agency for college students, starting at the local level to know that you can make a difference. So we encourage our students to engage with the community around them at all levels. It might be right in our own backyard in Harrisonburg and Rockingham County. It might be at the state level, the national level, or indeed at the international level. For example, in study abroad programs, we don't just have students in a place like Florence looking at the art. We have students that are doing community engagement by teaching English to underprivileged Italian students in the public schools, or in Ireland, where I visited with study abroad students, and they were working with troubled youth who were economically disadvantaged in Ireland. So it wasn't just that they were looking at paintings on the wall or admiring the wonderful geographic sites in these places, but they were actively engaged with the people around them. That, I think, is what makes learning come to life and gives students that sense of agency. And at a time when there's so much stress, when we hear a lot about the mental health challenges of today's youth and certainly of incoming college students, when you start to think about other people and concentrate on how you can use your skills and your education to make a difference in the lives of other people, that's when you develop that sense of agency, when you realize, I have skills, I can make a difference in the world. So it's very empowering.
Indeed it is. And I have to note that you've mentioned trips to Italy, France, and Ireland. You got a pretty sweet job.
You know, that's one of the hard parts of the job. Someone's got to do it, right? But I have to say that the international relationships that we have
sure.
been extremely important. If I could wave my magic wand, I would have all of our students study abroad. Right now, about 30% do, and we're continuing to try to increase that number, and not just in the traditional places, but indeed all over the world. I mentioned Kosovo, mm-hmm. For example, where I was a couple of years ago, and we're trying to get more students and faculty to go there. We have so much to learn from a society like that, the struggles that they are dealing with. And there's a country in the heart of Europe a lot of people forget about. The majority of the population is Muslim,
right.
By the way. So it's really important to them when you think about religious and ethnic diversity to be able to bring people together in peace. And we all know what the history of Europe has looked like in recent centuries when that hasn't happened. So they are very conscious of that history and of their responsibility. That kind of interaction, there's no substitute, I think, for our students to enlarge their horizons, to really interact with people directly where they live and work. When I was in high school, I went to Japan and spent a summer there through Youth for Understanding, and that was the first time as a white American that I'd been in the minority,
mm-hmm.
Living in a suburb of Tokyo, having people come up, little kids point to you and say the word for foreigner and mm-hmm. want to touch your hair to see if it was real.
Mm-hmm.
But what a great learning experience to see that not all cultures are the same, that people have different religious and ethnic backgrounds, that they live in different ways, they eat different foods, and there's so much we can learn from and with each other. It was a great, great experience. It's something I wish every student would
have. I agree
have.
With you, because despite all those interesting aspects of diversity, we share a common humanity. These are all laudable efforts, and I congratulate you, Jonathan Alger, the president of James Madison University, because I think it's fair to say, based what you're doing here at JMU, that Virginia remains in the vanguard.
Thank you, Stuart. It's great to be with you, and we're going to continue this important work in the years to come.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to my buddy, John Alger, the president of James Madison University. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our music is by Hannibal's Elephants. Check them out on Spotify. My name is Stuart Harris, and remember, you are a part of the American experiment, and that comes with some responsibilities.